Stay tuned for episode 16 of the Connected Kingdom podcast, connecting truth with life in a digital world. And welcome to another edition of the Connected Kingdom podcast. I'm Tim Challies. I'm here with David Murray. And by here, I mean very far apart, but each in front of our respective microphones. How are you doing this week, David?
Doing well, thanks, Tim. Good to be with you again. And we've got with us a special guest, Danny Hyde. Do you want to introduce him?
I'll leave that to you. I do want to point out that, as I understand it, you guys are currently sharing a set of headphones. Can you confirm this?
Yes, sadly, that is where we've come to, Tim. We are cheek-to-cheek just about over a microphone because we only have one set of fairly flimsy headphones between us. So,
right.
Enjoying some close Christian fellowship.
That's good. I guess that also speaks to the budget we have for this podcast. Now, why don't you go ahead and introduce Danny to the listeners?
Sure. Well, I'm sure many of our listeners will have heard of Danny before. He's a pastor in California in a URC, a United Reformed Church. He's actually a church planter. We're going to ask him a bit about that. He's the author of about 8 books, which makes you think he's probably about 60 or 70, but I'm looking at him and guessing somewhere mid-30s.
35.
Well, there you go. 35. And why is he here in Grand Rapids today? Well, he's been teaching a course on the Patristic Creeds this week to our, mostly incoming students. We've got a class of about 12.
About a dozen.
Yeah. And this is, of course, one of Danny's specialties, the Patristic Creeds, which is quite surprising when you think of the background that Danny came from. And I think he's going to tell us a bit about that.
Can we pause for 1 second for the benefit of some of our listeners and explain what a patristic creed is and why it would be something you teach in a seminary?
Yeah, what is a patristic creed, Danny?
What is a patristic creed? Well, for the sake of the listener, basically the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and the Athanasian Creed.
Gotcha.
Which are
Apostles' Creed, I believe in God the Father, Almighty, maker of heaven and
we're
earth.
We're not wanting the whole thing, Danny.
Oh, I'm sorry. How about in Latin or in Greek?
They're ancient confessions.
Ancient creeds that express the basic Trinitarian Christian faith in the person of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Yep.
So the theological foundation that binds us together with brothers and sisters from, more than 1,000 years past.
That's right, yeah. Catholic with a small c, ecumenical, universal, worldwide creeds that express basic summary of the Christian faith.
Good. Okay, David, where were we?
Right, well, we were going to ask Danny to give us a little, or maybe not so little,
yeah.
We're going to ask him to tell us how he came to the Lord and how he came to the Reformed faith as well, because I think that was a two-stage process, was it for you?
Sure, basically. And feel free to chime in, ask me a follow-up question if you have to. If I talk too long, it's because I have a long story. But basically, born in Long Beach, California, had a Roman Catholic mother and an unbelieving father, so baptized in the Roman Catholic Church like a lot of people. My first memories of church, though, were my father was converted in Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, which has spawned, at least here in America, a large movement, but it is international. My first memories of church then was going to Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. I think my first memory was Sunday school. If I think longer than that, I remember watching Thief in the Night for Friday night movie night. So very dispensational, very fearful in terms of the rapture and the second coming to keep us in line as I look back and think about it. My parents separated, divorced when I was about 9 years old. And in those early years and up until the time I was about 18, the only church exposure I had really was going to Easter, Christmas, Mass with my mother's side of the family, but always living, knowing basic truths about the fact that I was a sinner and that there was a God and that there was Jesus Christ, not knowing a lot about him, though. I lived in a lot of fear, a lot of guilt, a lot of condemnation, expecting to go to hell and to be judged just from the basic things that I knew. That was for years. Into my teenage years, my father had started returning to church and was going to a four square church, a charismatic congregation, Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. And he invited my brothers and I to church several times, never went, never really wanted to, kind of afraid, not really sure what was going to happen there. And then eventually one Sunday evening, I decided to go with my dad. And I remember sitting in the very back row. He sat with me, his arm around me. And after the service, we went home. I distinctly remember closing my door and crying a lot and calling out to God for mercy. And really dramatic for me, conversion experience, which, it basically got me on my Christian life, my journey. So that got me up to about that gets us up to about high school.
High school, okay. That's amazing.
Danny. Not so long yet, but
do you remember the sermon?
I honestly can't remember the sermon. Right. I know the pastor Zach Nazarian, still a friend, but can't remember the sermon. What exactly he preached on? I started to read my Bible voraciously, and actually in the youth group that I was going to, because I read the Bible so much, they asked me to actually teach the youth group, which is a scary thought, and. At the same time, the first two books my father gave me to read, besides the Bible, were both by Hal Lindsey, Late Great Planet Earth, and The Rapture. So that got me on that trajectory of Christian thinking and living. So.
See, this is interesting. So this week, so far, this testimony has gotten you from from Calvary Chapel to Four Square Church to Hal Lindsey, and this week you're teaching at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary. So I'm interested in how this goes.
I think that's quite a large step.
Well, yeah, honestly, it's amazing. I look back and see God's hand on me, and, I definitely sense that and know that. But, yeah, graduated high school. I played basketball in high school. I was fairly good, so I went to a college, played college basketball. And while I was there, we had to go to chapel. It was a small Christian college. And I had to go to chapel 3 days a week. Most of my teammates, if not all of them, professed to believe, but had no life at all to back that up. In fact, the most quote-unquote Christian of my teammates was my roommate, who was a Mormon. Wow. So he put them to shame in terms of his testimony, and that really disillusioned me. Going to chapel, seeing the same people going forward to altar calls and so forth, and the same people that I saw driving off to Tijuana on the weekends and partying and living lives of just nothing close to godliness really disillusioned me. I stopped going to church for about a year, although I read my Bible a ton. I read the Book of Mormon, the Jehovah's Witness translation of the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita. I read the Quran. I read basically every religious text I can get my hand upon. I took every course I could on religion, and I took a course on Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, visited Hindu temples, visited pretty much everything I could. And in the amazing providence of God, about the same time, I met my now wife, who was a very, how should I say, convincing Pentecostal.
A convincing Pentecostal.
Very, very convincing, very convicted of her beliefs, very strong in her faith. And the first question she asked me was, where do I go to church? And what a question to ask a guy 19 years old who's disillusioned and stopped going to church and is reading religious texts. At the same time, though, I had a professor, taught theology. We had a required theology class. And I started asking questions that I could tell he had never heard from pastors' kids and missionaries' kids. Finally, somebody to ask him some good substantive questions. He started to take me aside to his office every once in a while, give me some books to read. And Spurgeon was high on the list, Luther, Edwards, John Owen, John Calvin, Burkhoff, Gerhardus Voss, actually, at a Pentecostal college, amazingly. And about that time, 19 years old or so, I started youth pastoring in a Pentecostal church. So teaching every week and little by little learning about the Reformation, seeing the beauty of it, and really what attracted me was the stability. The rootedness, the fact that I didn't feel like I was wandering anymore, that there was something bigger than me. Teaching at a Pentecostal church, little by little, hearing of Reformation teaching, White Horse Inn Radio, Ligonier Ministries, R.C. Sproul, Michael Horton had started a congregation in Anaheim, which was near where I was in college. Attended there a few times. And the first time I attended a Reformed church, honestly, I could say it felt like heaven on earth.
Oh, amazing,
to me.
What a pilgrimage.
Yeah. Just imagine, which I'm sure we've all seen it or we've all heard of it, a young guy going to a Reformed church who has no idea when to stand, when to sit, when to open a hymnal. Was it upside down, backwards? I had no idea how to read music. Right. I had no idea what I was doing. But I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever experienced, the assurance that it brought to me. So long story short, I kind of dabbled with Reformed theology and Reformed churches for about 3 years because I really couldn't leave my church. I was a youth pastor. And then I was getting ready to graduate college, 1993, 97. And my theology professor said, what do you plan on doing? And I said, I would like to go to grad school, learn some more, get a PhD, teach some theology. And he said, well, you have two options. You go to Fuller Seminary, where everybody goes, or you can go and you can be a trailblazer. You can go to Westminster Seminary, California, in Escondido. And I had never lived further than 3 miles from the beach. When I drove to Escondido, it was hotter than Hades, we should say. So that's how I ended up at Westminster. And what's that?
The beach drew you to Westminster.
No, the Westminster is like 20 miles from the beach.
Oh, it's too far.
Oh, it was too far for you. It was so hot. I couldn't handle it.
Okay.
I'm very spoiled. So, I ended up at Westminster Seminary, California. I remember meeting my roommate, who's now a pastor here in Grand Rapids, John Clompine. And I asked him, John, where is the Reformed Church? And he chuckled and said, which one? I had no idea there were different kinds. So he took me to his church, the CRC, the Christian Reformed Church, and heard a sermon on Romans 9 that evening in the Providence of God, again, drawing me into that. And from that point on, my first year of seminary, my first Sunday there, I was at the CRC, which then became a URC congregation, graduated from there in 2000. So that's long story short, but that's okay. How I got there. Yeah, there's a lot of details that I overlooked, but the gory stuff I'll leave out.
It makes sense then that you wrote a book called Welcome to a Reformed Church, because you pass through so many of these experiences and you know what people face when they come into contact with a rather alien world.
That's right. Yeah, and the book was really my favorite book to write. I give something of my story in the book, a little bit of that. Really a personal story for me, really to explain basics of Reformed theology, Christian living, worship, some history in there, to show people who worship with us. And, you know, if the book reaches out farther than my congregation, that's fine. But I really wrote it with people that visit my church in mind, to give them a sense of, you know, the fact that we didn't just drop out of heaven and we didn't just start up yesterday from some charismatic leader. Okay. We've been here for a while, at least historically speaking, as Reformed churches. And here we are in Oceanside, California, trying to plant a Reformed church amongst all kinds of transient beach people, of which I'm one.
Right.
Okay, so we're hearing a whole lot about Reformed churches and Reformed Christians and Young Restless Reformed and all of this today. There's a lot of buzz about what it means, there's a lot of buzz about reform. So maybe you can tell me then, what does it mean to be reformed? How do you define that word?
Here's a minefield, right?
Yep, I think so.
He's ready to pounce up there in Toronto.
Yeah, there you go. I think we can clearly and safely say that, historically speaking, of course, to be reformed was to be a Calvinist or a Lutheran, to hold to some Protestant confession of faith, the Augsburg Confession for a Lutheran, the Heidelberg Catechism, Westminster Confession for us in the Reformed or Presbyterian tradition. But it is true that today we talk about Reformed Baptists or Reformed Episcopalians, Reformed Charismatics and so forth. And I think it's helpful for us in the first place to say, you know, to be Reformed is to be a confessional church. But at the same time, we realize that, you know, the word Reformed has some elasticity. It's used differently now, that's clear. And, people that hold to, generally speaking, most of what historic Reformed churches affirm, and even the confessions would explain, describe themselves as Reformed, and I think it's, it's fine to do that. Maybe not the most historically accurate thing, but at the same time, I think it's a helpful phrase to sort of gather us together as churches that, we do have differences, say baptism, infant baptism, speaking in tongues, not speaking in tongues, whatnot. But it's a helpful term to at least give people a sense of, at the outset, hey, this church does believe in a powerful God who saves powerfully by his own grace, and there's nothing that they can do about it. They can't resist it. They can't forfeit it. And he didn't do it because of them either. So, we can debate the baptism issue or church government issue and so forth. Not that those aren't essential, but really the heart of the Reformation, of course, is the gospel of grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone.
Does that satisfy you, Tim?
Well, yeah. So you think language just has to be elastic. So we can say Reformed used to mean one thing. Today we can just say we've reduced it to maybe this common denominator of believing in God's sovereignty and maybe a shared love for John Piper, and we'll just leave Reformed somewhere around there. We just love God's sovereignty, and we're going to, whether we're charismatic or Presbyterian or Baptist, whatever we, however else we define ourselves, we'll agree that God is sovereign and that he elects people to himself, and that's good enough for Reformed?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I definitely take a very patient approach to people that come to us, the young yet restless Reformed, or just kind of searching and not really knowing, do I want to put up a sign at front, listing the 95 theses of Danny Hyde, and if you don't agree, you can't come in, or am I going to want to have people come in? And sure, I want to convince them of all the things that we believe, but realizing that, I'm not able to necessarily at all times. And it takes time with people to be patient. And so, the term Reformed is one of those things where, I can argue with people about, the historical meaning of it or what I would like it to mean. But it's clear that in our context in North America, that especially given that we're so small and we live in a very secularized culture, I think we need to band as much as we can together in as many areas as we can. So.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. And I think I don't know that I see this as a Reformed movement as much as I see it as a movement just back to the Bible. And mm-hmm. If we want to keep Reformed in some historic meaning, then even if we don't want to use that word, I think we can still rejoice at what's happening, where people are coming back and saying, we don't want to be a church that's full of programs. We want to be a church that honors the Bible and draws all of our theology and all of our practice from Scripture. So I'm far more excited about that than people labeling themselves Reformed. And I'm sure you would agree with that as well.
Yeah, I would definitely, call myself Reformed or even a Calvinist. But when people ask me what I believe, I tell them I'm a Christian,
right,
and explain the person and work of Christ. And then, of course, I mean things by that, and I have to explain that. But I'm a Christian first. I'm Reformed second. I mean, I think they're similar, obviously. And to be Reformed is to be a Christian. But
right.
I think to explain to people Christian and Christianity and giving them a sense in a very confused time, what does it mean to be a Christian, let alone all the distinctives of the Reformed faith, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think there are two extremes to avoid here. One is, to set up, as Danny said, 95 boxes you've got to tick before you're called Reformed, before we allow someone the name. And the other extreme is, people who come to see one aspect of the historic Reformed faith and they start calling themselves Reformed, but stop there. Because whatever else the Reformation was about and our reformers were about, it was about always and continually reforming. And, I think who deserves the name of Reformed? Those who are still reforming, those who are still going back to the Bible, measuring their faith, measuring their practice, measuring their church life, etc., against the Bible and changing when it does not match. To me, that's what it means to be Reformed.
Yeah, my little book, Welcome to Reformed Church. The fact that I wrote that, for my congregation, but also, hoping that it can be used in other contexts. There's nothing in the book that is explicitly paedo-Baptist, and so I'd hope that Reformed Baptist Church would be able to use it. I even mentioned, as a friend of mine once said, who was talking to an Anglican. I even mentioned the 39 Articles of Religion as a sort of a hat tip to the Anglicans, just to be nice. So certainly, we want to draw people in and reform them and bring them the word and to be attractive to them and to be winsome and to be excited about our faith.
I think I know a blogger somewhere that's got some tagline like informing the reforming. Does that sound familiar, Tim?
I don't know. He'd probably be a good guy if he had something like that.
Yeah, probably. Sounds pretty sound, eh?
There you go, yeah. So I guess then we can see organizations like Together for the Gospel and Gospel Coalition and see that they're broadly ecumenically reformed, and we can be behind them and glad and not feel like we need to defend a certain brand or a certain type of reformed. We can just rejoice in serving the same God together. And I've just been so encouraged to see that. It wasn't long ago that the Reformed believers that there were very divided amongst themselves. So I'm very glad to see this level of just ecumenical agreement, just as we are able to cross those lower walls for the sake of the higher walls.
Yeah, and I think what I really like about what Danny is doing is, you know, Danny's coming from this very historic view of, you know, what it is to be a Reformed church and a Reformed Christian, and yet there he is in California planting a church, and there's no gimmicks, there's no trivia. It's really very solid, sound, and yet people are being attracted to it. Can you tell us a bit about your work there, Danny?
Sure. Like I mentioned, I graduated from Westminster in 2000. Before my seminary career was finished, I had actually started a Bible study in Oceanside with a few families that were traveling 20 miles or so to Escondido, basically to see if it would be possible to start a Reformed church on the coast of San Diego where there was no other Reformed church. Mm-hmm. And we had a couple of families, and that grew into a small group of about 20 to 30 people. And, you know, little by little over the past 10 years plus, we've grown to about 110 total souls, adults and children. But yeah, you know, very slow going, very difficult, you know, but I take great comfort to know that as I've studied the life of John Owen, at the end of his life, you see basically, as you look at the statistics of his church and the professions of faith and baptisms and so forth, basically John Owen, the last 10 to 15 years of his life, added 10 people a year to his church, and he died with a church roughly of 200 people. Right. So, you know, that gives great comfort to me. And also encourages me to continue on, not thinking of gimmicks, programs, shows. I mean, our church is pretty like plain Jane. You know, preach twice. We have two services. We teach catechism classes, Sunday school class, teach a Wednesday Bible study. We don't really have programs. We don't really have lots of groups. You know, we have a semi monthly, very informal men's group just to pray and to fellowship, a women's group, but very very focused upon teaching scripture, you know, inquirers classes, conferences, anything we can to expose people to the Christian faith, as well as to what we believe as Reformed churches. So yeah, slow going, difficult, challenging, but overall nothing but amazing to look back and to see how God has actually used a jar of clay, a shard of clay really is what I am, a shard, to use me to change people, and to see real conversion.